I'm Luke Cooper, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. It's been 4 years of all-out war between Russia and Ukraine. For those of us fortunate to live in societies at peace, it's hard to comprehend what this must be like. The routine sound of air raid sirens, the nervous wait to hear from loved ones on the front line, the strange feeling of maintaining daily routines, social circles and work patterns while being surrounded by all the reminders of the war. 4 years ago, as he launched Russia's full-scale invasion by land, air and sea, Vladimir Putin expected the war to be over in a matter of days. Some reports even claimed that Russian soldiers packed ceremonial gear for a victory parade. But Putin's army would soon be shocked by the resistance they encountered. Today, Ukraine still hasn't fallen, but it also hasn't won either. This is now a complex, attritional war for endurance against an autocratic imperial state that appears willing to absorb huge economic and human costs to fight on. Back in 2022, in my day job at the London School of Economics, I kicked off a research program to study the war. This wasn't just a narrowly academic exercise. We were always clear that this was research for a purpose, to help develop policies that support Ukraine's democratic institutions and deliver a just and sustainable peace. And two of the colleagues I've had the privilege to work with are joining us on today's show. Roxolana Nestorenko is a researcher at the Kiev School of Economics, and Taras Federko is an academic with positions at the University of Glasgow and the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. If you're unsure of what to make of the war, its history, and some of the debates it throws up, then this is the show for you. Roxolana, welcome to London. You've made the trip all the way from Kiev this week. It's quite a journey, 24 hours by train and then plane. You must be completely exhausted. You were straight into LSE yesterday for a conference. We had another meeting this morning. I know you've got some plans for some sightseeing, though, and some rest time. What's on your itinerary in London in the next couple of days?
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, it was a long journey, but fortunately I'm here. And also, it's actually not my first time here in London, but the first one was like quite briefly. It was 2020 and I was traveling through London. So I saw only the subway stations and nothing more, unfortunately. But now I want to see everything probably.
And I remember, right, you studied at Edinburgh.
Yeah. Glasgow. Yes.
Right,
nice. I was there on Erasmus Plus program, and actually I was studying Russia, Ukraine, the collapse of Soviet Union. So it was pretty close to what, what we
quite
will...
place to study in Glasgow.
We just found out that Ruslana studied on a program that I taught on for a couple of years after that.
Very nice. Mm. Keeping it in the family. So yeah, itinerary list in London. anything on your plans for the next 2 days?
I have probably the Nature History Museum.
Natural history. Yeah,
I really like dinosaurs. You know, this because I saw one in Glasgow. This they have a university.
No, those are provincial dinosaurs. Look at the metropolitan ones; a lot better here.
So probably I will go there. Yeah. So
okay, very nice.
I rely on people, on friends, maybe on you. You can say something very like I need to go probably. I have a couple of days, so
maybe the Tate Modern. Yeah, Tate Modern's a good shout. It has a great Nigerian modernism exhibition at the moment.
I'm going there just after this show.
Oh, okay, fantastic. There you go, you can go together. So now we've got the tourism out of the way, obviously this is a, you know, This is a grim and difficult topic, and you've been in the absolute heart of it. So when I spoke to you a few weeks ago, Roxolana, I think you said, was this a week or 10 days ago now? I can't remember, but you said the weather had improved a bit, It's been a really difficult winter, but your definition of the weather improving was that it reached -9. And we've had in London, in England, a very mild, very wet winter, and it definitely doesn't reach those kind of temperatures, but it's been incredibly cold. And you've also experienced these massive Russian attacks on energy infrastructure. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course. Actually, I'm warming up here in London, so I'm trying to, you know, to have all this like quite good weather. Like, it's much better than in Ukraine as of now. But I know that what I said to you about the weather, it was like we had -20, and everything were like very hard. But it's, this word will not, you know, explain everything that people experienced it, because it connects to where you're living. Because Kyiv is one question. Kyiv is very large city in, of course, in the case of Ukraine, many millions of people. There is a lot of problems with infrastructure, especially the Soviet time one. And for example, myself, in a house where I rent a flat, I woke up at 4 in the morning because of the sound of, you know, tropical rain, and just was the pipes were bursting. Because of the, we had these problems with electricity. Electricity connects to the heating plants, and if there are no electricity, we should shut down plants, and all water just left the pipes, and no, like, it's not warm. It's not comfortable when you're in your flat. And then in case the -20 weather, there should be no water in this pipe. So it's very engineering one. And now I understand everything, how it's worked, because of the, you know, practical problems. And the pipes were bursting in like different places. And it's like all over the Kyiv, and also there is no electricity and no connection sometimes. But, you know, it's like we get used to it. It's not the first winter. It's not the first year of the full-scale invasion of Russia. And we adapted to it, especially, for example, our university, Kyiv School of Economics, helped co-workers a lot. So we had the power banks, we had these, you know, like small heating, I don't know, it's pouches in case of something, like if it's really, really cold. Because I had, at my home, I had probably 12 Celsius, even less, because we try to, you know, there's electricity, you have like electricity heating, I don't know how it's called, but we are like had this opportunity to have a little bit of heat. Casey is helping co-workers and students, and we are trying, you know, to work this out, to sometimes find some, I don't know, places to warming up. We have such like central places that Kyiv authorities created. It's not enough, of course, but now it's better. The winter is like, we are saying goodbye to this winter, fortunately, and we will have more.
Thaw has come. So those central places, just to be clear for the listeners, right, these are places that the local authority has created as hubs that people can go to when there isn't heat in their home,
of course.
So it's sort of this adaptation measure, right?
Yes.
And how would you describe the mood in Ukraine now amongst your friends, your contacts? I know it's a big, complicated country, as we're going to discuss, but what's your sense of how people are feeling?
Of course, I'm like, I know only what my friends are doing during these times, because actually there's not so much energy, like inner energy to contact everyone, to be, of course, like I have relatives that living in like their own place, their house, and they wrote me like, if you don't have any energy, power, you can go to our place. And I was like, oh, that's very sweet of you, but I don't want to, you know, to bother you. Because I understand that many people find their own coping strategy, their own ways to, I don't know, to deal with it. And probably for most of the people, it's like less because you're, for example, if you don't have any electricity and you don't have, and there's no schedule of this electricity, because before, in case of the attacks, we actually had, because the attacks were not so severe on the infrastructure, we had some schedules the local authorities do for any city. So it's like different and individual for your house, for even like we could be like in one quarter, but we could have different energy schedules. Mm-hmm. And so the mood is very, we are dependent on these schedules, and there is no schedule. We just simply, I don't know, you're living and trying not to freeze in your apartments, and you're trying to do everything to warming up, just a lot of, like, not like me right now, but a lot of like the jacket, then probably even wore like the outdoor jacket on me, and there's a lot of layers because you need to warm up, and your brain sometimes is just freezing. I don't know how to explain, but you're very limited in actions, because you, it's just like the simplest action you need to do to warm up, to eat something, just to work somehow, to sleep, and then again it's quite like it was. For me, I adapted pretty quickly, I suppose, because we had like electricity, like small station, and we can charge it. And then we had electricity for even, I don't know, to everything that we need, like the simplest one. Not, of course, for refrigeration. Yeah. Just,
well, you don't need that in, the, in that context.
Yeah, we didn't. We, didn't, we just, actually, yeah, I stored everything on the balcony. So,
so what you're describing in a way is a series of adaptations, right? So there's personal adaptations, there's local community, there's state authorities, whether at the local level or the national level. And I guess that's been one of the themes of the Ukrainian story over more than a decade of conflict now with Russia. And so, Taras, like, stepping back from the present moment, can you bring some of that historical context in for us? There's been 4 years of all-out war, but the conflict with Russia goes back to 2014. For those that aren't familiar with these events, can you give us a little bit of that history?
It's a question of whether the history begins in 2014. It obviously doesn't. But you can try to understand that the beginning of the conflict in two different ways. On the one side, you have a long story of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the change in relations between now separate states, Ukraine and Russia, where Russia had, and Russian leaders had for a long time, not all of them, but many, had for a long time seen Ukraine as part of that core imperial as part of the imperial core. So think of Ukraine as the Ireland of the UK or as Scotland of Great Britain, right? I mean, in relation to Russia, it's, or as Algeria of France. It's something that's for several centuries was part of that imaginary of the Russian state. Kyiv as the mother of all Russian cities, etc., etc., right? So when the two states become independent, there are various kinds of tensions around how much sovereignty and independence in its foreign policy and domestic policy should Ukraine have. And those tensions come to a head in 2014 following protests in Kyiv and all across Ukraine, the so-called Euromaidan or Maidan protests known as the Revolution of Dignity, which, and here's the second way you can look at it, which are part of the global wave starting with the Arab Spring, of a kind of a counter-reaction to economic and political problems that begin with the global financial crisis and the fallout of the global financial crisis. The protests bring to power a coalition, kind of a motley crew of westernizing Democrats, economic liberals, neoliberals, nationalists, who oppose a pro-Russian geopolitical orientation of the deposed president, Viktor Yanukovych, and who are, again, opposed by counter-protesters in southern and eastern Ukraine. And at that point, late February, early March 2014, Russia starts to foment unrest through a network of agents, finding fertile ground among counter-protesters, the counter-Maidan in southern Ukraine, in Crimea, in Donbass. Some of them managed to seize administrative buildings across those regions. Russia sends in troops in disguise to Crimea, seizing an opportunity, and annexes Crimea, big prize, right? Opening up this whole Pandora box of a new, absolutely new kind of relation between Ukraine and Russia. And then that's when these sort of opportunists of semi-paramilitary kind step in Donbass, where they, acting from the bottom up, try to seize administrative buildings, protesting against the change of power in Kyiv. And Russia is a bit slow to react, but starts supporting them, sending them weapons and stuff. And that's the beginning of the Donbass war, as we now know it, with local separatists aided by Russian, you know, at some points, Russian intelligence, Russian arms, sometimes Russian troops in disguise or sometimes openly, beginning of the war in Donbass, that Ukraine struggles in the beginning to control because of that Russian independence. That happened in the spring, early summer 2014. And as a result of that, more than 2 million voters basically fell out, were taken out of the Ukrainian political system, right? So you have Crimea that's controlled by Russia, you have separatist controlled territories in East Ukraine. Those people can no longer vote for pro-Russian, to simplify, pro-Russian parties. And strengthening the westernizing camp in Ukrainian institutions in Kyiv, enforcing the drift towards the West, which meaning that it's even more difficult for Russia to control Ukraine's sovereignty as it'd been trying to do. Because up until that point, Russia was meddling in internal affairs. It becomes more difficult to do that, making a military intervention a lot more plausible as an option to Putin. So following 2019, when President Zelensky comes to power with his political party assembled around his persona, there is some hope, I suppose, in the Kremlin that there would be some kind of normalization around this peace process, the so-called Minsk peace process, which was kind of a Trojan horse for Ukraine's sovereignty, but still the only possible at the time a peace resolution, a conflict resolution platform. But that hope very quickly dissipates because Zelensky sees that actually the problems are structural, right? If East Ukraine is to be integrated back into the Ukrainian state together with the separatists, it would gain power that would make the project of independent Ukrainian statehood not non-viable, right? And that again makes the intervention by the Kremlin, the military intervention, more plausible. Which eventually they do. I mean, they've been preparing to that, but right, it's not just an individual decision in the Kremlin. I mean, when I teach this stuff, I say, forget about Putin. Putin doesn't exist. I mean, there's a structural drift towards conflict that begins when Russia opens up this Pandora's box with the annexation in Crimea and the support of the separatists in Donbass.
Really interesting. And Roxolana, your family fled eastern Ukraine, Luhansk, that our audience might have heard of as part of Donbass, one of the two separatist enclaves that were declared so-called People's Republics. What do you remember of that period at the outset of the first phase of the war? And what was the decision of your family like in that moment? I mean, people might not realize actually, but you know, there was really quite intense fighting at that first phase of the war, particularly in July and August 2014. It then became a much more sort of attritional, dissipated thing. So what was that experience for you?
Mm-hmm. I was a teenager back then, so I was 15, 16 almost. I was like, of course, this was a decision of my parents to leave. It's not mine because I wasn't realized the seriousness of everything that happened around me. Because of course, when you're a teenager, you're like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I was thinking about I was in 10th grade. So I was thinking about the ball that we will have after the 11th grade, the dress, everything like this, but not about the everything that was going on around me. But then actually what happened that it was very, you know, slippery slope situation, because when I was at that time, I was reading Twitter, and there was a lot of tweets of Ukrainians that were on Maidan during this winter, when there was many people were killed, and by the like a authoritarian state that Ukraine was at that time. I mean, Yanukovych and his all of his clique. And then I must say that it was like, it was in Kyiv. For us, it was like kind of far away. Mm-hmm. You live in the like Luhansk region, for listeners, just very quick info that it is close. It's not like close to Russia. It's like the borders with Russia. Mm-hmm. Like
literally sticks into Russia.
Yes, almost. Like I don't know. I never been to Russia, so I maybe fortunately, I don't know. I never been there, but probably it's not so many kilometers. Like. Mm-hmm. 30, I will be wrong, mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. but 30 kilometers to Russia.
From where you were living.
Yeah, Luhansk. Mm-hmm. I was living mm-hmm. in Luhansk, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. The region, the center of the region. And at that time, I remember that my parents were afraid of me, of course, because I had some, you know, French language classes after school. And my father said to me, I will go with you. I will wait. It was during, not after school, but maybe weekends. So he had time to just guided me to this teacher. And then he waited for an hour. And then because he was afraid that at that time it was probably March. And then April, it was the most hard months for Luhansk because the... central, like we had this probably is oblast, it's I mean regional level authorities building were seized by the this backed Russian backed as like you call it separatists. At that time we called it like that, but now I understand it's probably people that were paid. We call it actually Tetushki. It the name from Maidan. It was actually one guy who's very like who was paid to do different stuff on demonstration, mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. provoke. Mm-hmm. He was a provocator.
Yeah. Thugs. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thugs. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It's just simply mm-hmm. with the sports costume. And mm-hmm. so we had a lot of these people in Luhansk for that time. So, of course, my parents were like afraid to... Like,
And to be clear, like the militias on the street, basically, yes, is a way of talking about it, right? With guns. Yeah.
It's just simply people with guns. And we were like... Mm. What should we do? And probably it was why I said we would sleep really slow because I felt that people were really, really afraid to spoke up because of these people with guns, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. we didn't feel at that time that some of the, I know that some of the people from we now have police, but before that, we had militia, so mm-hmm. milice, I don't know how it's called in English, but we had these security structures, and some of these people were just switching sides.
I see, yeah.
And
well, it's funny you mentioned that, so I'll just throw this in, because when I was in Lviv at the end of a trip in October 2024, I actually met another colleague from Luhansk who had been a student at the university, and I think her story resonates with what you're saying, because staff and students at her university were instructed to go on these protests against the Maidan and had all of these sort of strange in some ways, or as she described it, strange anti-Nazi, anti-fascist language. So you are instructed to mobilize in the public square against fascism. So it's a very sort of contradictory, almost like 1984 Orwellian style thing. You must do this. And I guess reflective of a local administrative bureaucracy and a local elite that was basically becoming a client of the Russian state in this period, could we say?
Mm, yeah, yeah.
I mean, what you have there is... a breakdown of center-regional relations. There's been mm-hmm. some interesting books written about that mm-hmm. since, because there is already that distance that you can look at what went on through archives and oral history interviews. And there's this breakdown of center-periphery relations among elites as well, right? I mean, suddenly mm-hmm. the main patron in Kyiv is replaced by a rival revolutionary coalition. We call it more democratic, but for those people in positions of regional power in Luhansk, it was a catastrophe, and they weren't sure that they'd be able to maintain their positions after the Maidan, right? And so they do, I'm not justifying them, but they do what perhaps in that moment seems rational, which is they're trying to make claims against Kyiv by supporting, instructing people to protest against this invented spirit of fascism, whatever that is, right? In order to make a claim against Kyiv, say, no, we don't like this. And it goes a bit too far, and Russia meddles in, and it basically spirals out of control. Now we can tell the story of Russia stepping in from the start and the intention being very, very clear. But I wonder how confused those local elites might have been at the time themselves, not quite knowing how far it would go. It wasn't the first time this happened. Something similar happened in 2004, during the 2005, during the Orange Revolution, a protest against Yanukovych and unfair elections, right, where there was a proposal to form an autonomous union of eastern, southern, eastern Ukrainian regions. So in a sense, there is this pattern of regionalism and peripheral relations with the capital, that is still there in 2014. It's an old pattern. It's a pattern that had been set by how exactly, you know, how the Ukrainian state developed under the Soviet rule, with this really strong power on of regions and their strong control of resources. Except that this time Russia steps in and gives the weapons to thugs, and it goes a bit too far.
Right. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll return to the pivot point of February 2022 and how it would change Ukraine forever.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing, whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
If we could move the conversation on a little bit, because I know, Roxolana, you've looked at this, you know, Ukraine has this sort of famous and self-identifies, Ukrainians identify as the do-it-yourself people in a way, or this do-it-yourself activist culture, and that's often associated with the anti-corruption protests that Taras just mentioned, the Orange Revolution in 2004, and then the Maidan revolutions in 2014. Some of the research adds some kind of nuance to the story of that do-it-yourself culture that you've done. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, of course. We did this research. Actually, my team started it before I joined them, and then I was like very involved into everything connected to this project. It was 3 years of surveys, and then, of course, it's like qualitative, quantitative survey of 120 activists that are living in their communities. It's nearly 40 communities all around Ukraine, except occupied territories. And it was started in 2023, then year after year. And of course, we did some conversations with them, some focus groups, some interviews. So it's just very scientific research, researches. But we had a lot of like communication with them, and through their answers, we understood that it's actually very interesting that half of them, even more than half of them, were not a part of the Orange Revolution or the Maidan, the Revolution of Dignity. And here is like several answers why they're not part of that, because they were too young, especially as a me, for example. also probably because they were not living in a big cities, because mm-hmm. we have communities. It's not only city communities, mm-hmm. it's also like the rural one. And people there, they didn't have, they like, there is no chance to protest against who, for example. So in Kyiv, there was protest against the authority, the Yanukovych, and from who you will be protesting in your village. So probably it's like there is no opportunity. But the full-scale invasion of Russia changed like everything, because it was not about the protests and centers of protest. It were not about the cities. It was about the territory of Ukraine altogether. And the amount of activities, this initiatives, I don't want to say it was NGOs, it wasn't, it was like a lot of initiatives on the ground level that appeared. It was, as you said, do-it-yourself situation, so probably many of them were doing simultaneously the same work in the same city, and then they it was an evolution of this initiative. Some of them became NGOs, some of them just dissolved because they don't need to do something, because the aim of their work were, I don't know, helping IDPs in this community. And for example, these IDPs returned to the occupied territories, and there is no aim to work with. So it was very, you know, chaotic at first, but then probably it became something more.
So, Taras, what do you think about this idea? I know you've written about this and you can tell us about it. You know, Ukraine has a very strong culture, as Roxolana was saying, of active citizenship. And this is interacting with that protest history. But as Roxolana was just saying, it actually goes much wider than that in some ways. And in 2022 does seem like a pivot point, that suddenly it's a whole society mobilization. So can you tell us about that a little?
It takes a long time to prepare a revolution, or to get to a position where you can have an explosion of civic activity and solidarity of the kind that we saw in 2022. And I might say now something that some of my colleagues in Ukrainianist sociology and Ukrainian studies would disagree with, but I think the idea of active citizenship is something that goes back in different ways, partly to pre-Soviet period in Ukrainian socialism of kind of post-World War I era, partly does go back to understandings of Soviet citizenship, where there was this grand project of moving to brighter future of the entire Soviet Union, which was achieved one citizen at a time through orientation, active orientation and embodiment of a greater ideal in one's individual behavior, right? And that interestingly changes and kind of transmutes through the years of Ukraine's independence, leading to kind of, it becomes this cultural orientation for activists in smaller networks that mobilize one protest at a time. In the early 2000s, in Ukraine against Kuchma, in 2004, in 2014, and each time their networks grow, right? Though some of the activists stay, others fall off, new people join. But what they do, they elaborate a certain kind of script for civic behavior. They learn. Some readers might be familiar with, you know, learning what to do with tear gas, for example, or what to do with the kettling of the British police in a protest situation, right? How to what to do not to be arrested in an anti-genocide protest. There's that civic learning, political learning, and there are networks that are forming. And so some of this stuff that we see in 2022, when you have hundreds of thousands of people starting to donate, starting to buy for, you know, humanitarian reasons or to the military, starting to organize to procure whatever the military or civilians need, the foundations for that are laid in 2014-15, when Ukrainian troops and displaced people do not get enough of what they need from the Ukrainian state. And what is learned in that moment gets amplified on a massive scale in 2022, right? So there's a certain kind of script that gets learned and that's preserved, a certain understanding of what active citizenship is and what activism means, right? That you can step in and supplement the state. And this, many activists, I don't know how it is in your research, Roxana, but in mine, these crowdfunders or volunteers, as we simply call them in Ukraine, I think it's quite telling that you'd use a very general word such as volunteer, to describe something that's very specific, right? Which is aid in the military or the IDPs. Because here, you know, in English, volunteer can mean all kinds of things. It could mean someone joining the military voluntarily. In Ukraine, it means something very specific, telling you that act of aiding the state and the public good through active volunteering has become sort of writ large as a script of Ukrainian good citizenship. So many of these people like to tell a story about themselves, which is they are replacing the state, that they are against the state because it's them rather than the state performing that act of, you know, bringing the contributing to the public good, which the state should be doing. But I think actually it's more accurate to look at them as people who govern together with the state, because they supplement what the state is doing. They often try to lobby for this or that public decision at the local level or nationally. So in a sense, you have that effervescent project of collective participation in politics that few other states in Europe have seen, I think.
Yeah, and I think that changes the relationship of NGOs to the state in quite a big way in some ways. I mean, it's really common when I've met NGOs in Ukraine to find that they're actually engaged in the implementation of projects, whether that's for international financial institutions or for the Ukrainian government itself, where they've applied for a bit of money, got a grant, and now implementing something. And this will often be organizations that in other ways have quite a contentious relationship to the state. So they're also engaged in advocating for environmental justice or for social rights or for producing policy reports. So there's a sort of dualism or mutuality there in their relationship to the state that you're describing. And the other thing that struck me as you were talking is that the story and analysis and narrative you're presenting about Ukraine's post-Soviet history contrasts so vividly in some ways with what Russian human rights activists today at this conjuncture will tell about the story of Russian citizenship, because they will broadly say, look, there's a block of society, it's a minority that has drunk the Kool-Aid and really supports ethno-nationalism. And I guess in some ways you could see that as a form of active citizenship in a particularly reactionary way, right? That they're quite actively engaged with what the government is doing. There's a minority that's smaller that is opposed but is very repressed and is against the war. But then there's this block in society that are atomized, extremely passive, that make up probably the, you know, perhaps even the numerical majority, or certainly a majority in a plurality of Russian society, i.e. the biggest single bloc, that have this extremely alienated relationship to the public space and are just engaged in acts of personal survival and cynicism and bitterness. And that seems like a really big unevenness, if you like, in the stories of narratives of what's happened to citizenship in the post-Soviet space. But the other thing I want to ask you about, Taras, is that how this has actually materially impacted the Ukrainian war effort, because you've been researching fundraising efforts, often through online and digital means, that have erupted, and how do they interact with the military in quite an interesting way, I think.
I'm interested in what that fundraising does to understandings of citizenship, what it does in terms of the resources that it can mobilize for the front line, and what impact it has or might have in the longer term on Ukraine's political culture and institutions, right? So in numerical terms, crowdfunding, huge as it is, we're talking about several billion dollars, pounds, donated to the front line a year, every year since the start of the war. through organizations, some of which are foundations and NGOs, but very often in very minor ways through private bank accounts and savings accounts. And Ukrainian banks kind of play ball in that game, right? They made various kinds of fintech solutions available to Ukrainian crowdfunders and volunteers. But even that, you know, those several billion, that's not that much compared to what the war costs, right? Mm-hmm. So the state is clearly the main player. But what's interesting is that relatively small financially as that crowdfunding milieu is, it has had an outsized impact politically on the idea of what the state should be doing. It's had an impact on the kinds of stuff that has been bought, right? So my favorite example to this is drones. Everyone's heard about this new transformation in Ukraine, right? Ukraine is, quote unquote, a future warfare, blah, 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 where small drones are now the main cause of casualties for both sides, actually, in the war. Up to 3/4 of confirmed kills by Ukrainians Russian troops are by small weaponized drones. These drones they are there because crowdfunders and crowdfunding networks, they didn't just buy those drones in the first instance from Chinese producers and intermediaries in Poland and Lithuania. They instituted schools for pilots. They lobbied the government to make funding available for them. They joined the government as deputy ministers for defense or strategic industries to build up an infrastructure for procurement of drones. They persuaded military commanders. So you can think about crowdfunding as something much broader than just a procurement exercise, or as a form of tax, if you will, mobilizing resources, financial resources for the war effort. It's a broader kind of mobilization where crowdfunders act as activists who broker not just money but ideas. They bring people together. Many of them set up parallel defense companies, right? And then innovated new fundraising mechanisms to channel money directly to those defense companies so as to have more flexible kinds of finance, right? Not to have to borrow from a bank, for example. Some of those activists are anti-authoritarian anarchists, you know, constructing drones and creating new networks among these kind of left-wing activists across Europe and across continents. So that's what interests me, that kind of fermentation of new connections that I think, if you look back to history of other wars, where this happened, those networks stay, even if the purpose for which they are deployed, for which people mobilize, change, right? So they were laying the foundation for a new kind of politics in Ukraine in the future. And we'll see what that looks like at some point.
And Roxolana, in your research, you've talked about a transition from this whole society mobilization, if you like, in the conjuncture of 2022, February 2022, where there's this moment, I was going to say enthusiasm, but that's not quite the right word, a moment of enormous popular resistance in the face of the invasion, and now to something that's slightly different. Maybe could you tell us about that? What kind of terminology would you use to describe the mood mm-hmm. at this conjuncture 4 years later?
Mm-hmm. It could be like a scheme that starts with like so-called rally around the flag phase, then some kind of new normality, and then institutionalization, working under the strain, the resilience under the strain, actually. But it's, of course, it depends on the city, on the region. I can say that this phase were like, probably the first phase was only in 2022, and then people became, they started working. For example, myself, at that time when the full-scale invasion happened, my project were ending in a couple of days, February 28th. So I volunteered for a couple of weeks, and then I joined the NGO that were actually working with activists. So it depends. People normalize everything because mm-hmm. you need to somehow work in this crazy situation, because war is really mm-hmm. crazy and its impact on your mind and everything. So we had this understanding of, you know, these steps, but of course it's just conceptualization what was happening these years. And we had actually a conversation with activists this year, a month ago only, and it was very interesting because people who appeared, it were mostly people from frontline regions. So they had almost no electricity. They were like, it was focus groups, and some of the people were like, I see that they launched from phone on the street, because only on the street you can have some mobile internet. So it was like very interesting. It was people from the NGOs that working with people with disabilities. It was a lawyer that is working actually in his free time, if he has free time, with refugees, Ukrainian refugees outside of country. So they had some problems. He helps them. And you see that we had the conversation with them last year, and it was very interesting to compare it. Because last year I felt from this conversation that they want to be heard. And this year, the isolation, because they're from living near to the Russia, near to frontline regions, they feel isolated. They want to be heard. They want to have somebody, as me, for example, a researcher from Kyiv. They want me to see what they're like working on, what things, and they want tell their stories. And it's very, I'm very honored, actually. It will be very maybe pathetic to say, but I'm very honored to be the one who is listening to them, and I want to translate these stories. Of course, we're doing it anonymously. We don't say any names or their like where they living, but I want to say that it's a very big issue, because when you're living in a frontline regions, probably there's much less humanitarian missions started to go there, because of course Russian drones are very effective, unfortunately, now, and they even go to the big cities, to outskirts of Zaporizhia, for example. One of the activists said to me that there is called, like you said about the drones, and there's a lot of ways to make this drone. So the larger one, the smaller one. And there is also so-called drone žduny. It's some like drones that are waiting. They could hide in on the side of the road, and then where there could be car, or especially they hit civilians, not only military, of course, because Russians' methods are very different. But this activist said that they have now very... they have more safety issues than before, even. So it's became harder. And I want to say that this conversation with them were the most hard me to hear, because despite I'm living in Kyiv, we also had these attacks and everything. The frontline regions, they are hurt the most.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to imagine, like for any of us to imagine what that must be like. So the other thing I think that it would be good to talk about right now is that, Taras, you mentioned earlier that the mobilization of voluntary fundraising for the armed forces was significant in this, the political sociology you've talked about, and, you know, $2 or $3 billion, a couple of billion pounds.
Doesn't hurt.
It's not to be sniffed at when it comes to fighting a war. So it's a serious amount of money. Of course, at the same time, Ukraine is extraordinarily dependent on financial flows from allies. How could you tell us about that, the scale of it, and how do you think it impacts, say, Ukraine's room to maneuver in the negotiations that drag on and on and on with the Trump administration?
I think that's one of the main reasons that we have negotiations of this kind. But I'll get back to that in a moment. War is incredibly expensive. With the start of the invasion, Ukrainian state has had to spend enormous sums on that, right? The defense budget has increased and then increased again. And now it's about 60 or so, $64 billion a year. I can't remember the exact figure. That's half of what the Ukrainian state spends. So the state has assumed a much greater role in society. At the same time, it has had to prioritize military expenditure over others, right? So currently the Ukrainian state earns about the same amount in taxes and duties and levies as it spends on the war, leaving a major hole in the budget on all of the civilian welfare spending, civil service salaries, and other forms of reconstruction expenditure, which have to be filled somehow. It also gets some military aid, right? But a lot of the aid grants and loans that Ukraine has received, they are spent on civilian budget lines. And every year, in a rather uncertain fashion, and throughout every budgetary year, there are these ongoing negotiations about with multiple donors and allied governments, Japan, the EU, EU countries, UK, US, about the funding that could be committed to the Ukrainian budget, right? So that's, we're talking about around $60 billion a year for the last couple of years, with the funding that is never committed over a longer period of time because it's ginormous sums of money for the allied governments as well. Which it's not just the fact that Ukraine needs that money every year and it is dependent on Western government. It's the fact that these sums aren't committed in a stable fashion over a long period of time. They have to be renegotiated continually in ways that intersect with the political cycles in London and in Brussels and in Washington. As we've seen with Viktor Orban's Hungary using EU's aid to Ukraine as a way of leveraging political pressure onto Ukraine. Aid to Ukraine in Brussels, less extent London, greater extent Washington, has become an issue of political competition and struggle between domestic political forces or, you know, constituent parties to the EU. That means that there is a direct feedback line, basically, between the front line and political negotiations in Kyiv and the state's capacity to plan budgets and spend money on whatever it spends money on, and domestic political conflicts in London, Brussels, and Washington. And that means that it's not just dependence, it's great instability. Mm. And the Ukrainian state is trying to, and the government is trying to negotiate that, but it's incredibly difficult. Mm. And I think it would be difficult for any state. Any shortfall in funding directly translates to setbacks on the front line. It translates to unpaid salaries for frontline medical workers, to teachers and others. Yesterday in Kyiv, the head of the finance committee in the Ukrainian parliament, Netmantsev, said that the Ukrainian government has already dipped into the part of the budgetary spending set for the second half of the financial year, the budgetary year. And unless there was external financing forthcoming, the state would run out of money. Mm. So that's the dependence we're talking about. It affects the political dynamics in the country, in Ukraine. It affects the military dynamics, and it's transforming the basic infrastructure of the Ukrainian state.
May I add some couple of words? Because what you said about the how it's affects the especially frontline regions from this discussion with activists that I had previously this year, they are actually they're indicating this financial problem also to their activities, because they need to be paid sometimes, because if you're working with, for example, first medical aid, you are teaching children to do this, because, yeah, of course, we don't have so much people to teach it in the frontline regions the people from local self-government. So they're also dependent on different grants. They need money to, for example, to rent some places or to renovate the underground, because you need to the
shelters.
The shelters, yes. You need to make shelters from every possible place, and so there is money. Mm. The money also not only on government, local or state government activities, but also for small interventions for everything.
Right, let's take a break here. In part three, we'll talk about the relationship between democracy and identity, and in the process, debunk one or two myths about this war.
Hello, I'm Sasha Ismail. I'm a member of the Committee of Ukraine Solidarity Campaign, one of our two trade union liaison officers. USC is the UK's trade union, social movement and left campaign in solidarity with Ukraine's struggle for self-determination and with its social movements. We were founded in 2014 by John McDonnell and trade union activists to oppose the war Russia was then starting in eastern Ukraine, counter disinformation and build links and solidarity with the Ukrainian workers' movement. Since 2022, supporting Ukraine's resistance to Russia's full-scale invasion, we've expanded. We have hundreds of individual members, seven national affiliated trade unions, as well as dozens of union branches, and activist groups in unions, as well as towns and cities. We're an extremely active campaign. As well as trade unions, we have supporters organising in the Labour Party and the Green Party. There's also a separate Ukraine Solidarity Campaign Scotland that we work very closely with. At the same time as mobilising against Russia's war, we make solidarity with Ukrainian social struggles, from youth-led protests against corruption to LGBT struggles to trade union battles to defend workers' rights against Ukraine's neoliberal government. We see all our campaigning as part of a global battle for democracy and human rights against rising right-wing authoritarianism. Just as you hear this, we've recently organised a rally in London and a big event at Parliament to mark the fourth anniversary of the full-scale invasion, as well as helping organise rallies around the UK. There'll be more coming up soon, so please do get involved. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook and X, and read more, join and learn how to affiliate your organisation on our website at ukrainesolidaritycampaign.org. Thank you very much. Solidarity.
Last year, Steve Witkoff, one of several billionaires in the Trump administration, very eclectic administration, from renegade leftists to conservative supporters of Labour legislation to billionaires. It's a classic, if you like, regime administration in some ways, not so different to what some of the dynamics that Taras was talking about in Ukraine, right, earlier, in terms of patronal politics. We now see that in Washington. Now, this patronal Trumpian administration doesn't seem to have a good grasp of some of the issues, let's say. And Witkoff gave an interview where he said, basically, that the root and fundamental issue at stake in the war is that the people in eastern and southern, southeastern Ukraine want to be part of Russia. What would you say to him if he was here?
Probably that he felt hard for Russian propaganda. He felt in this trap. Because what I must admit...
You're very polite.
I must admit that what is Russian... like propaganda machine doing very good, that is taking something that could be true, small truths, and exaggerate everything around it, like making like different stories that are not even not true. They are false from its core, and it's very easy to fall into this, because as I said, that could be some true. So as you said about the separatist movements, and you mentioned the 2004 Orange Revolution, there were some political elites in Luhansk, Donetsk region and Crimea also. There were some people that had very good communication with Russia. I mean, different way, business way especially. And of course, they were like... it's better to save our assets and to have these tetushkas, these gangs saving our assets, because in case of something, we don't want to be part of this. We just want to, you know, it's our. But nevertheless, about the, you know, about the situation, about the people, maybe the only fault of the people of that were like, not so politically involved. They're like average one people. The only fault that they had that they didn't resist. They were not supporters. they just didn't understand the level of everything that was happening all around. So for myself, of course, I was a teenager, as I said, mm-hmm. but my parents were like, we didn't realize how deep these connections with Russia of some of the local elites were. We didn't realize how everything will like happened. And probably because of the people with guns on the street, this like very marginalized, I saw it. It was like my father one time, we were in the city center, and as I said, the administrative building were actually occupied by these people. And the park across the street were also occupied by them. And actually, it's very strange place. I mean, this park, because previously after the Second World War, it was the cemetery of German military. And then they were like, you know, then they became a park. So it's like, it's a messed place from all along the way. And they did some kind of, I don't know, some kind of place for them to be all day long with flags, with Russian flags. I saw it and I was like crossing by and I was like, where they find these people? They're not people from Luhansk. I never met.
You know what Hillary Clinton would say? She'd call them a basket of deplorables, I think.
Because they're like, that's not people from even from our, maybe it was some people that were so marginalized that they were paid by many these Russians and the local elites that want to be friends with Russia, of course. But it's not like average person from Luhansk at that time was like, I just want to be silent. Mm. Everything actually became so silent at that time. We were like in a, it's called marshrutka. It's a bus, but the not the best one. And because the city didn't have so much money to and so much courage and management to do better infrastructure. Yeah. So everyone were so silent because everyone were like the trust level felt so low. Many people, and it's Donbass, many people, their relatives came to Donbass from different parts of Soviet Union, from Ukraine, all over the place, especially my family also. And probably this caused so much alienation and atomization in these cities that we didn't have trust to anyone before, and then the Russia started to, you know, back in these separatist movements and sending their people to directly to Ukraine with like there, of course, it was like very in disguise. They were in disguise, so we didn't know who it was. Now we know. As Tara said, now we can, you know, trace the sequence of events, but back then we didn't realize what is going on, and probably it was a fault of people that they were not cautious enough, and they were too atomized and didn't trust each other.
Well, that's really careful and responsible and nuanced, but which obviously wasn't what Witkoff was doing in that interview. I think he meant to be referring to Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk. But it was a bit of a misfortune for him because he couldn't remember the four names of the particular oblasts in question, right? Which maybe undermined his argument. Now, the two of us together visited a different oblast, but it's not so far away from Donetsk, Dnipro, in October 2024. And that would also feature on the meme version, if you like, of the Witkoff comments, which I haven't seen one for a while, but at the outset of the full-scale invasion, there were these maps circulating in some information spaces, maybe put out by problematic Russian troll accounts in some cases, but also naively projected by many leftists and conservatives alike in these information spaces. And Dnipro would feature in such a map in the sense that it's very Russian speaking. It's in that old Ukrainian industrial heartland territory, right? And we met colleagues there who are undertaking the kind of volunteering work that we were talking about earlier, right? That we're going back and forward from the front line supporting the Ukrainian war effort. And Taras, this is one, wasn't the only case of that kind of dynamic. There's one that our colleague and mutual friend Denis Gorbatch talks about in his blog that has this nice vignette about the local elites in Kryvyi Rih, another eastern Ukrainian city. Again, would feature on the troll map, if you like, of the Ukrainian culture wars. Could you tell us a little bit about that vignette from the outset of the war, and why does Gorbatch see it as significant or revealing about the dynamic of that pivot point and conjuncture of February 2022?
So for the listeners, Denis is an anthropologist, Denis Gorbatch is an anthropologist who's done a study of this classic heavy industrial city of Kryvyi Rih in central Ukraine, I suppose, in Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, which is the location for the ArcelorMittal-owned steel plant alongside other sort of heavy industries. Classic example of a heavy industrial Soviet town constructed or expanded in this long wave of early Soviet industrialization in the late 20s and 30s, I suppose, where these couple industrial enterprises and mines that there are form the basis for employment in the city, right? I mean, it's more like the towns in further east in Donbass than other places in elsewhere in the country. And he wrote a brilliant book about it, and in the blog that you referred to, he tried to follow up on what changed after he stopped doing the research there. And he found that despite many of the people that he'd known, including local administration, in the past supporting what he calls the Eastern Slavic identity, right? So broadly speaking, a geopolitical orientation to Russia, support for the Russian language, support for in the political culture of the place, support for symbols of the old Soviet state and memory politics. In spite of all of that, following the full-scale invasion, there was a complete reorientation towards a very different version of being Ukrainian, right? There's nothing wrong, I think, in being a Russian-speaking Ukrainian. Ukrainian is a bilingual, or was more of a bilingual state than what it is now. But it's difficult to imagine for the English-speaking inhabitants of the British Isles, right? But it's a bilingual society with two languages mutually understandable. And there was one version of that in Kryvyi Rih, and people are reorientated towards something completely different, something that's more familiar to us among the westernizing protesters from the Maidan, including the mayor or acting mayor of the city, Alexander Vilkul, who shifted from supporting, being a former supporter of President Yanukovych and kind of the pro-Russian camp to supporting the nationalist troops on the front line, right? Doing a lot to stop the advance of the Russian troops from the south, putting his personal weight and connections, mobilizing the labor unions and others to stop the advance of the Russian troops from the south. So that's the effect of rallying around the flag that I think mm-hmm. Roxolana talked about, that's visible elsewhere in the country. Mm-hmm. Now, Denis wrote about it I was at a conference with him at the Polanyi Center, where he first presented that what became the blog piece, the Polanyi Center in Budapest. He wrote it in June 2022. Things have changed since then, but he was interested in how this previously apolitical group of workers and citizens in this place in central Ukraine suddenly, despite being your classic populist, quote unquote, despite being this group that would normally vote for patronalistic populist groups in parties, that they started to mobilize in support of the troops and in support of the IDPs, right? They were in one sense apolitical, of the kind that you normally would see in mm-hmm. Russia. So people who just don't want anything from the state except for the payouts and welfare, don't want to participate in politics actively, just want to be left alone so long as their living conditions are guaranteed, suddenly becoming much more active. And I think that effect has kind of possibly has worn off, but mm-hmm. this is what he wrote. There was a fascinating moment of choice, of political choice, a kind of a living laboratory, really, of Ukrainian politics that he describes.
Mm. And that existential moment, I mean, I wish we could just carry on talking about this on the sofa all day, but Roxolana has some sightseeing, well-deserved sightseeing to do. So before we go, can you just say very quickly one thing our listeners and audience can do to take action?
One thing that I want to say probably is to support the Ukrainian military. If you can do it directly, if you are from outside Ukraine, you can do it by... We have a lot of big funds that is working with supporting military. We can also have funds that supporting people. We have the Come Back Alive Fund, I suppose, like Поверніть живим, I suppose, like sounds in English, and also Притула Foundation. It's very, like, they're very clear with their reports on what they're spending money. So you can do it if you are not sure in, I don't know, in what this money will come to. And also we have like United 24 initiative. It's also very like clear what they spend it for. So it's my...
Absolutely. And it's funny you say that because not so long ago, I think it wasn't this year, maybe a year or so ago, a colleague at the LSE asked me for a cause to donate to support Ukraine and said in an aside, oh, I would donate to buy a drone if I could. And I said, well, it's funny you mentioned that because you can actually donate to buy drones for the Ukrainian armed forces, as we've just heard. But Taras, what's your recommendation?
I absolutely second that, but I think it's worth also supporting small initiatives. And mm-hmm. one of them is Kollektivy Solidarnosti, Solidarity Collectives, which is an anti-authoritarian network supporting both troops on the front line and civilians in difficult circumstances. They support anti-authoritarians and anarchists and left-wingers on the front line. They are set up by Socialny Ruch. So support them. Support Free Filmers, which is an initiative set up by Sashko Protyak together with colleagues from Mariupol. They are a displaced collective of culture workers and artists who do a lot to help civilians in southern Ukraine, specifically in Zaporizhia region. They support the elderly and the displaced people. So those two small causes are very well worth supporting. They accept donations from the internationally. So Solidarity Collectives and Free Filmers.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for coming on and having this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Right, so that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Counterpower is produced by Another Europe Is Possible, Global Justice Now and Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organisations, look us up, get involved, there's lots to do. And remember, you can support Counterpower by hitting the link in the show notes for our crowdfunder. We're aiming to raise £8,000, so please help us kick this project off. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again very soon.